This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How hard is it to figure out what you're paying for in aged care? Whether for you or for your loved ones. Have you signed a contract for a loved one and felt pressured to pay for things you know they won't need, that they can't actually even physically use? Or have you been asked to pay for things you think are essential? I'm Mary Guerin and I'm back in The Conversation Hour Chair. Lovely to be back. We are continuing this discussion that unfortunately we've had on this program before. I'd love to know your experiences and your thoughts about this. We all potentially might be heading towards this. We need to have a good system, and the system that we do have in aged care homes around what services people need to pay for, around fees and payments in general, is clearly troubled. The national regulator has received nigh on 200 complaints about aged care service charges and fees to residents in just the first half of this year alone. 200 in 6 months. At the same time, there's a class action against a major provider alleging that fees for things like high teas and exercise classes were illegally charged to clients who can't even use them. Part of all this picture is the new scheme that was called the Higher Everyday Living Fee. It's called HELF. It came into effect in November last year. It's meant to clear some of this up. It's meant to tease out which services and lifestyle additions we should pay for because they go above the mandatory standard of care. How well is that working? It was meant to solve some of the problems. We're going to dig into that on this Conversation Hour. And also, you'll get some advice about what to do if you're confused, if you have a problem. But I'd love to know your stories. Please give me a call and let me know. Also, what did we learn from Bazball? Remember that? Remember that name? Remember that crazy, super aggressive, super risky style of play that the England men brought here for the Ashes last year, said it was way of the future. It had given them some big successes before it did ultimately lead to their humiliation in Australia. Did you hear? It's officially dead now. Overnight, we've had the sacking of Baz, the Baz in question, Brendan McCullum. He was the England test coach and he's been taken from that role. Did you like Bazball? You can admit it now. Look, it's dead. But maybe, at least initially, you thought it was entertaining. You were really wanting it to come to these shores. Even though it did lead to England's downfall, of course. You might remember the last Boxing Day test. In fact, some of those tests were only 2 days long. Maybe you blinked and you did miss it. Maybe you don't remember it because of Bazball. But what do you think we learned from Bazball? What's its lasting legacy? Maybe even if it's just the Test cricket should never be meddled with again. I'd love to hear from you. Did Bazball bring you some excitement? Should some of those principles remain? Or tell me all of your thoughts on the English folly that was Bazball. But coming up next on The Conversation Hour, how hard is it to figure out what you're paying for in aged care?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Are you faced with paying for services for your loved ones in aged care that they can't use, or services that you think should be included? How hard is it to figure out these contracts? I'd like to hear your stories because many more of them are coming out. We have heard that the regulator, who will be speaking to the commissioner who's in charge of this, have received 199 complaints in just the first half of the year alone about all sorts of things when it comes to fees and charges, and we'll get her assessment of the situation. But first, Dr. Sarah Russell is director of the advocacy group Aged Care Matters, who's been looking into this and can talk us through her concerns about the sector. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Oh, thanks, Mary.
Overall, I guess we'll get into the class action that I was referencing before in a moment. But what do you think is the current state of play when it comes to the clarity and the, I guess, justice of services and fees in aged care at the moment, 2026 Australia?
The Look, things have improved, there's no doubt. Prior to the new policies, these extra fees were included in your contract. You had to either sign the contract to get your loved one into the aged care home or not sign the contract. Now, at least, the fees are a separate contract. So that is an improvement, but there's still many, many problems with it, as we can see by the complaints we've had in the last 6 months. And one of the big complaints is, why am I paying for this? Isn't the new Human Rights Focused Aged Care Act including these things in the standards, like meals and choice of meals? It's the choice of meals that has really upset me. Some of the aged care homes are requiring you to take out what they call a bundle, or the higher everyday living fees, a bundle, and that includes a choice of meals. Surely an older person living in an aged care home should have a choice of meals without having to pay extra.
That's right. And just to clarify for people, as you've mentioned, Sarah, we're talking about complaints, that 200 included complaints that were post this new system, but also were ahead of that new system, pre-November. Jenny has called from Fairfield with her story. Hi, Jenny. What do you want to say?
Good morning. I just wanted to say how much the services have declined since I was first became a recipient of my aged care.
In what way, Jenny?
Well, I've recently moved from my home to an apartment so that it's easier for myself. And I did ask recently, could I have a spring clean and the windows cleaned in my apartment? And I had my caseworker came out last week and she said, no, they're no longer providing those.
Right. So, Jenny, you're not in an aged care facility. You're not a resident in an aged care facility.
No,
you're
not
right,
at all.
In
no,
the community.
No. And I hopefully I don't ever have to go into one because I know exactly what they're like. I've had dealings with my family in all of them. So my grandmother, my mother, my uncle, and none of them were very nice at all.
Yeah, well, Jenny, that is the dream for so many of us, to try to avoid that. That's supposed to be part of the system. But thank you. That's not part of the stats that we're talking about here, but it is, Sarah, still something of a snapshot of services across the board when it comes to aged care. Let's talk about the class action that's gone, that you've been writing about. It's concerning one of the larger aged care providers.
Look, I was aware that many companies do this. I was, you know, not only the company that I wrote about, but what upset me the most about the case that I wrote about in 2024 is it was clearly illegal with consumer law to charge people for services that you are not delivering. And I had solid evidence of about 10 people who were being charged for things that they weren't receiving or were unable to receive.
So just to interrupt you, Sarah, is this part of you're presenting this as evidence towards this class action against
R-Care? I am. Yes, I am. I collected quite a lot of people before I actually wrote about it. But I wrote a very solid piece because the commission was aware of it. The commission had received many complaints over the last 5 years about this particular company charging for services that were not delivered. And the problem
And we should just say though that class action is still before the court. There has been no determination.
Absolutely. I'm not jumping the gun here. I'm just suggesting that there is evidence that the commission was receiving complaints. And one of my complaints is that the commission didn't act. We talk about having these commissions receiving 200 complaints. And my question is, what are they doing about those 200 complaints? Because in the past, these people who complained, one of these people who complained about her mother who'd had a stroke and was unable to use any of these extra services, and as I mentioned in the introduction, these services were embedded in a 50-page contract. So it's a big contract. You're desperate to get your loved one into a home for care. So you sign the contract, not really aware that you've also signed for $35 a day extra for these services.
Certainly, and the opacity of those contracts is at stake. Just to let listeners know, we will be speaking to the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commissioner, Liz Heffron-Webb. She's on the line and I believe listening, so we will get a response to this, Sarah. But even beyond then what the Commissioner will no doubt say, that and has been reported, that the Commission is looking into this, do you not believe that the system is working in that sense?
I would like the regulator to have more teeth, I think is the expression. One person in my study, she was told after her complaint to go and get a good contract lawyer to deal with this company. And I think, really, if they're doing something that's not lawful, or allegedly not lawful with consumer law, which is why the class action has been lodged, surely the regulator should be able to make that company stop doing it. And it's been going on for many years. This is not recent. This is going on for many years.
Dr. Sarah Russell, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sarah Russell Byers is a director of the advocacy group Aged Care Matters on the Conversation Hour. And as I mentioned, Liz Heffron-Webb is standing by, who is the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commissioner. Thank you so much for joining me, Liz. What would you have to say there? Let's go to what Sarah was talking about. Let's first go into the nature of those complaints. She's saying that when it came to the class action that is against R-Care, that these were incidents that were known to the Commission. What's your response to that?
Thanks so much. So the issues that were raised around R-Care were raised under the former legislation. So I'll just wanted to make that clear. In terms of how we handled any particular complaint, I'm you know, disappointed to hear that people felt we weren't taking it sufficiently seriously, and that if we did tell people to get a contract lawyer, I don't think that was an appropriate response. Having said that, we do have a new Aged Care Act. There are much stronger protections for older people under the new Act, and we are investigating all complaints and are engaged with aged care providers where we think their behaviour doesn't match what's required under the standards.
I'm speaking with Liz Heffron-Webb, who is the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commissioner. 1300 222 774, if you have a story about some of these contracts as well. Another thing that Dr. Russell brought up there was the nature of these big contracts that you have to sift through to find, and that has changed with this new system. But how big a problem is the opacity of these contracts?
Well, entering into residential aged care is a stressful time. I think there's no doubt about that. There's been a lot of work done to try and improve the accessibility of the materials for people and to give more guidance and support to people navigating that journey. As we said earlier, the higher everyday living fee contracts are now separate, so that you can't be asked to sign those as part of signing up to enter a residential home. And if people are still finding that they're being asked to sign up when they're trying to enter a home, you know, please contact us. We're on 1-800-951-822, and we'd be happy to hear from you and to help you navigate this, because providers shouldn't be doing that. Notwithstanding that, I don't underestimate what a stressful time it is and how complex it is for people.
So for people who have these stories of pre-November contracts, they still can come to you with any complaints about their contract, and that's part of this 200 that you're talking about?
The 200 is since the new Act, but some of the matters may relate to pre 1 November, and they do range across residential and home care. So we're looking into a really wide variety of complaints about pricing, about transparency of contracts, just to make sure that people are aware what they're paying for and are getting what they're paying for. And I just wanted to also say one of the most important things that we're concerned about is where there people are being charged for access to choice of hot meal, because older people in residential care, often very frail, very vulnerable, and it's hard for them to get their protein requirements daily without having access to, say, a hot breakfast with eggs or a choice of hot meal at night. So we would see that as very much part of the standard care offering, is access to that kind of nutrition, those nutrient-dense foods.
And how many meals a day is the standard, as far as you're concerned, to have that choice?
So certainly they should be offered a protein-rich hot breakfast, in our view, and then a choice of hot meal at another point in the day, and regular snacks as well, and drinks, etc.
Is it fair to say that that health system, the ins and outs, the minutiae of what is should be expected to be standard and not, is still being thrashed out, or is it a matter that it's actually quite clear and some providers are not making it clear?
Well, it is fairly standard, and it should be pretty clear because it's in the residential care service list, which is what...
Where would people find that if they needed to check?
On the health, on the website of the Department of Health, Disability and Ageing. It's called the Residential Care Service List, and it outlines what should be part of standard care. And it's quite clear that it should provide access to nutritious meals, snacks and drinks always, and that they should meet residents' preferences and needs, as well as basic items, toiletries, heating, cooling, showering, cleaning of rooms, clinical care. So extras really should be for premium style options, such as glasses of wine with dinner or restaurant kind of level service, or for lifestyle and entertainment type of matters. So we think it's clear, but we'll keep working to make it clearer, and in all our engagements with providers, we do try and work with them and seek to improve their understanding, as well as to try and change practices that we don't think align with the standards.
I'm speaking with Liz Heffron-Webb, who's the regulator of all of this, or the commissioner in that regulation body. Liz, this has come through on text and a couple of times, that anything run for profit will always be rorted. What is the evidence in terms of profit versus not-profit complaints?
We get complaints about both. There's no particular pattern about a higher level of complaints for profit, although there might be on some individual issues.
For-profit providers worse in some aspects than others? Or
look, I don't...
Worse is the word.
I don't want to draw out any particular issue. I'd have to go back and look at the data. But I think in general, we have a mixed system in Australia. We have many good for-profit providers and we have many good not-for-profit providers. This is really about the standards. And so, you know, I understand some people think, have a view about the presence of for-profit providers in the system, but they are part of the system and they've been part of the system for a very long time, and we work closely with them, and many of them are very committed to a great experience for older people.
Before I let you go, to another of Sarah Russell's points, do you need more teeth, bigger teeth? Do you have enough powers, or would you like to see more?
So we're very excited by the additional powers we got under the new Act. It does give us more opportunity to take steps, including to take people to court for civil penalties. We're in the early stages of the new Act. We're only 6 months in, and so we're still learning how to exercise those new powers. We're learning what's possible, and so But the minister has also announced some additional consumer protection powers.
So you should have enough.
That enable us to make refunds, to require people to provide refunds, etc.
And look, a question without notice, and I do only bring this up, Liz, so apologies, because we did have this discussion some weeks back on the Conversation Hour when it concerned charges for basic TV. I'm getting a few texts saying, well, what about homes that charge for basic, I think, free-to-air TV? That's from Tom from Brunswick. Has there been a ruling on that? Is that part of the residential care service list?
Look, TV is not part of the residential care service list.
Should it be? Well, that's a
reasonable question, and I think a lot of people in the community would say it should be. What we've been saying is if you were providing TV before 1 November, you should continue providing that because people have a reasonable right to expect that. We wouldn't want to see TVs removed from people who've had it. It's not strictly speaking on the list of must-haves. Now, that's something, you know, I think it's something the community might think should be, but at this stage it's not.
Mm. Liz, I really appreciate you joining us today. And that number again for people who might have queries,
1-800-951-822.
Thank you so much for helping. I'm sure a lot of listeners will be taking note of that number.
Great.
Liz Heffron-Webb, thank you. Liz is Aged Care Quality and Safety Commissioner. Mary, you've called in. What did you want to say?
I've broached the additional fees charges on two occasions with the current nursing home. Mum's been there for over 4.5 years. And unfortunately, we did sign up for the additional fees initially. In the meantime, the contract changed, which we weren't made aware of. But she's been paying for things that she's not been using. And basically, I spoke to the aged care people. And if she's getting some or any of them that go to the value of $25 a day, there's not much we can do. However, she's being charged, the bulk of it is for a meal choice, which he wasn't even getting until the 20th of February this year.
It sounds like, though, from what Liz Heffron-Webb was saying, that you may have a case if you call the regulator.
I think it's a basic human right to be able to have the choice of a meal. On top of that, TVs were being charged at. One of them was hers for the majority of the time. Mm. And telephone line to her room was estimated at $136 a month for a landline because she can't use a mobile.
$136 a month for a landline.
That's what the assessment was. So whether you have a landline, and it's and I've just been met with dead ends.
Yeah. Oh, well, 1-800-951-822 apparently is the number to call there.
Yeah.
Mary,
thank you
so much for sharing your story. Carl in Ballarat, what did you want to say?
Oh, look, thanks for taking my call. I've looked after a sibling in a nursing home for 21 years and had a complete range of experiences with it. First thing I want to say is standards. The standards you can drive a truck through. Now, example of that is the standard says we have to give each recipient or person there 450 grams of protein. Where does the protein come from?
Yeah.
And sausage rolls and party pies, do they eat? We used to see this all the time, and this was a big organisation. I fought battles with them time and time again.
Are you comforted by what the commissioner then had to say, in terms of the eggs for breakfast and so forth?
No, because the other thing on top of that is accreditation. The week before accreditation, we'd be a mad flurry. Let's get everything ready. And even though, look, spick and span, accreditation come along, 2 days later, it's all back to normal again.
Carl, thank you so much for giving us that insight. Things are trying to change, aren't they, since November? There is that new act, as the commissioner says. It's only that few months old. They're trying to figure it all out. Hopefully things are getting better slowly, and if not, just for people who might want to hear that number again, 1-800-951-822 is the number that the regulator has said to call if you're having problems. And also later this hour, if you are also interested in this time of life, maybe also you are thinking of or so have friends or relatives who are in the position of needing to consider age-related macular degeneration. Once upon a time, that was guaranteed to lead to blindness. But later on this hour in the Conversation Hour, we're going to be speaking to Melbourne-trained world-leading researcher who's going to tell us what the situation is then. So stick around for that. But it is time next to talk about, apparently, the death of Bazball. Did you like it when it happened? Is there much to learn from it? I'm already getting texts saying, actually, they're going to miss a bit of it. That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And I will get to more of your texts and calls about the aged care system. And also I want to hear from you, Bazball. Was it all bad? We can say it now that it's over. It lasted this era of crazy cricket, about 50 tests, but we saw it on our shores in the Ashes series. It led to a lot of successes for England, at least at first. It was a risky approach. Let's listen to some of what we was talked about over this Australian summer.
And England break the drought. After nearly 15 years, they finally get a test match win in Australia.
A lot of Barmy Army fans here that have travelled a long way and spent a lot of money to see high-quality test cricket over 5 days, and we haven't got it in Perth, and we won't get it here.
I think it's attacking cricket. This is Bazball. Let's go.
Banging that back over the bowler's head.
Short tests are bad for business, you know. It can't be much more blunt than that.
A two-day test. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
It'll be a financial disaster for them.
So they are the highs and the lows. Yes, England did win that Melbourne test, but of course they got smacked otherwise in the Ashes. We're calling it the end of Bazball officially because the sacking overnight of Baz himself, Brendan McCullum, the coach. Joining me now is Daniel Bredig, the cricket writer, to, I don't know, celebrate or commemorate in terms of Bazball. Daniel Bredig, thanks for joining me. Of course, your Age's chief writer, the author of a book on cricket. How did you ever stand on Bazball?
It was very entertaining, but ultimately it didn't have the substance that you require if you're going to be one of the world's best cricket teams. And I think that's, in the end, where Brendan McCullum's time as England coach has come to an end. I think all of the off-field behavioural issues they've been having, I think a lot of those things would have been smaller issues if England had been winning more matches. And obviously, losing the Ashes 4-1 in Australia, that was a pretty big margin of defeat, and I don't think he or Bazball ever recovered from it.
That's right. And so, yeah, it's going to this news that he was sacked. I mean, I read this morning a headline saying that he was gutted. I was surprised that it took this much time. What do you think?
One of the complexities of it is that he is, or halfway through his tenure, he moved across to be the coach of the England white ball teams as well. And as of the moment, he will still be the England white ball coach. He will coach the team in ODI and T20 cricket, but not in Test cricket anymore, which is obviously how he started in the job. So I would think that a lot of the discussions and a lot of the delay, I suppose you could call it, was a little bit to do with that. And also the fact that the ECB had signed him to a contract to the end of next year. So there's some kind of financial settlement that they'll have to reach in and around that. And also, clearly there was a view from the ECB at the end of the Ashes that they didn't want to do the usual thing, which is if you lose the Ashes by that kind of a margin, generally England cricket dispenses with the captain and the coach. They wanted to try to keep Ben Stokes and Brendan McCullum for a while, but they've ultimately both gone anyway.
Just really quickly on the coach aspect, who's the front runner there?
In England, there's a strong lobby for Andy Flower, who's coached England before. He currently coaches in the IPL, and he is as different to Brendan McCullum as you could imagine the difference between oil and water. He's seen as a disciplinarian. He actually did a little bit of assistant coaching work with Australia in the last Ashes series in England in 2023. You would see a very, very different England team if he were to take over.
Certainly wanting stability. Tell me what you thought of Bazball. Is there anything you're going to miss about it? Sue in Clifton Hill says, I'm going to miss the comedy aspect of laughing at England stuffing up their cricket strategy with Bazball. It was funny. And this is, well, Bazball was entertaining. Plus, we beat England all the time when they employed it. So win-win, what's not to love? Daniel Bredig is with me. Daniel, I mean, it started off, as you say, it was entertaining. Is there anything Is there any legacy to Bazball which is good, you know, an influence that we should retain? It did hold a mirror up to Test cricket for a little while, made us all consider what we really liked about it.
I think it was a form of cricket that was very suited to the times in terms of, if you think about, you know, sports and anything really, in whether it's politics or culture or business, wanting to isolate things down to, you know, a clickable clip that you can watch on Instagram or TikTok or what have you. It was that kind of Test cricket. The only problem, of course, is that if the opposition wants to find ways around that sort of hyper-aggressive approach, it's not going to work so easily, and it can lead to some pretty ugly defeats, as we saw in Australia, as we also saw in India. And the fact that through Bazball, England had a bit of a bump in results for the first couple of years, but they couldn't beat Australia or England in a they couldn't beat Australia or India in a major series. That's really the litmus test for whether a method of playing Test cricket is seen as successful. And ultimately, that's where they've fallen down. And it concluded somewhat ironically with a series loss to New Zealand. The same team that obviously was the origin story for Brendan McCullum, and also the first team that England played at the start of Bazball and got a very different result.
And just finally, Daniel, I mean, there'd be a lot of people who thought, you know, England was, and it's true that England had, you know, fantastic talent within that team that were let down effectively by a strategy. Now that they are potentially veering away from that, should Australia consider, looking back, just consider themselves lucky in that Test series, that Bazball was there to, as a sort of a 13th man?
To a degree. Certainly, if you think about the first test of last summer in Perth, England had the game on a platter and threw it away in a session. And that's something that I think everyone connected with the England team is going to ruminate on for a long time. Certainly, I don't think Ben Stokes, as captain, ever quite recovered from the shock of that experience. And also, the other thing about the England setup that Bazball created was that there was this element of the laissez-faire, and that extended to what was going on off the field as well as what was happening on the field. And if you look around the world, there's a number of teams, including Australia, but I'd also include New Zealand. I'd certainly include South Africa, who won the Test Championship last year. Teams that have succeeded in creating a relaxed environment for players to enjoy, but also treating them like adults and expecting them to behave and, you know, swim between the flags. And England were never quite able to do that, which, leaves plenty of questions for whoever succeeds Brendan McCullum.
Indeed, quite the job ahead of them. Daniel, thank you for joining us again.
No problem at all.
Daniel Bredig is the Ages cricket writer, chief cricket writer, in fact, and author as well. Keep your texts and calls coming in on Bazball. What might you miss? Or is it just a really lovely memory for us all? Coming up on The Conversation Hour, we're going to be speaking about the Geelong-based theatre group that's celebrating international recognition for its work. But next, what is different these days if you're diagnosed with age-related macular degeneration? We're going to be talking to Melbourne-trained, world-leading researcher about this. What's different these days? It's hopefully good news.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, three decades ago, going blind from what is called age-related macular degeneration was considered inevitable. But it is, in fact, the 30th anniversary for the Centre for Eye Research Australia. And the person who's with me in the studio is the Deputy Director of that centre, Professor Robin Geimer, is AM, because member of an Order of Australia, for all of her work that she's done in this area. And she is here to mark that 30th anniversary and to tell us what is different. If someone in your life, if your friends or relatives have age-related macular degeneration as well, tell us your story. Robin, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, pleasure, Mary.
30 years ago, tell us about the diagnosis when it came to age-related macular degeneration. Should we just call it AMD?
I think that'll be very useful. Yeah, so 30 years ago when I had finished training, AMD was a disease that we really had no treatments for, what's called the late stage of the disease. So many of us have the early signs, which are these little deposits in the back of the eye called early or intermediate AMD, and they cause no symptoms. But in some of those people, they progress to what's called late AMD. And the most devastating one is where there's bleeding suddenly happens in the back of your eye. And 30 years ago, we had no treatment for that. And then in around 2006, we started being able to inject into the eye a drug that stopped the blood vessels from bleeding. And that truly was miraculous. So we have these injections, which unfortunately are often lifelong, but they prevent the sudden, profound scarring in the back of the eye.
And so how many people would have AMD and could be treated by these injections?
So one in seven people over 50 have the earliest signs of the disease.
Wow.
But only one in seven of those will go on to lose vision as a result.
I think we should pause here then for everyone who's over 50, myself included, and say what the things that we should be looking out for that would then take us to the doctor.
Yeah, so it's the commonest cause of poor vision in people over 50 in our sort of communities. So really it's that opportunity to go to the optometrist for your glasses should be an opportunity to check the health of your eyes, not only for macular disease but for all other aging diseases. And so one message would be don't always get the cheap glasses from the chemist or online. Take it as an opportunity to get your eyes checked when you're over 50 from the optom. And they will show on their scans or their examination these little deposits, little yellow deposits at the back of the eye. And they just increase the risk of either two things happening. One is the bleeding, for which we now have relatively good treatments. And the other one is the cells just dying slowly, like little moth-eaten holes in the vision. And that's called geographic atrophy or dry AMD. And that's the one in the last year or so we finally have our first treatment being approved from the Australian regulators so that we can use that.
Right. And I want to circle back. I hate that term, but I've just used it. Apologies to everyone who's triggered. I do want to go back to that topic about what's been seen within the past year. But just on that eye test, are the things that you're talking about going to be picked up by the Medicare funded eye tests that we are allowed? Is it over 50?
Yeah, so certainly you need to go to an optometrist who will have a look inside your eye, and often these days they will take a photograph or an image, and they're the things that can pick up these early signs. But in particular, if you have a family history, because it does run in families, as does other diseases like glaucoma, diabetes, you should mention that to the optometrist so that they will particularly look at a particular area of your eye. But yes, without having that examination, you won't pick it up. Australia doesn't have like a screening system where everyone over a certain age has their vision looked at.
We are speaking to Professor Robin Geimer, who is from the Centre for Eye Research Australia. If you have any questions as well, 1300 222 774, about age-related macular degeneration, which we are calling AMD, on and off here in this conversation, do give us a call or text 0437 774 774. Robin, you were talking about the things that have emerged within the past year. Tell us more about that.
So whilst we could stop the devastating and quite sudden bleeding in the eye, we don't have the ability to slow down the progressive loss of retinal cells, which are part of the brain, really. They're neurons. And so Centre for Iris Australia, was a part of international studies using drugs that seem to be able to slow that risk down. And so in 2025, the TGA approved for the first time a treatment which blocks the inflammatory focus in the back of the eye to try and keep cells alive for longer. Again, they're injections in the eyes. They're not currently on the PBS, so they're very expensive at the moment, but it's our first step forward ever in being able to slow down the natural history of this disease, which is slowly cells in the part of the eye that you need for reading, driving, recognizing faces were going to die, you know, very slowly but over time, and that's the one that really impacts vision.
So who would have access to this treatment then?
So at the moment it's an expensive every 2 month injection in the eye, and so it's very limited availability at the moment, but we're certainly hoping that the PBS are considering potentially putting some part of the number of people that need this treatment onto the PBS, but that's certainly not approved at this stage.
Mm. A listener is wanting to know if the big eyewear chains do the testing for the back of the eye in the one that you're referring to that will pick it up.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yep. They should be able to tell you how the health of your eye is.
Yeah, back down to that. And also I was reading that you that we also have breakthrough in terms of figuring out the genetic aspect to this. Tell us about that.
So we've always known that AMD runs in families, and in fact it was one of the very first what's called chronic diseases where we were able to pinpoint particular small changes in the genes that increase your risk. So it's not like just one gene causes the disease. There's many little changes that we all have that either increase or decrease our risk. So that's been really known for, again, about 20 years. And this new treatment that we were just talking about is based on those genetic findings. So one of the major genes that cause or associated with AMD is involved in an inflammatory pathway called the complement pathway. And so these injections are blocking that pathway in your eye. And there are many trials underway currently in Sierra and elsewhere around the world looking to see if there's different ways we can block that pathway that doesn't require a every two-month injections for forever in your eye. Mm. But more recently, ourselves have been involved in trying to tease out a very bad form of macular degeneration, and we were able to identify a particular change in the gene that increases the risk of that sort of small group that do very badly, and that should hopefully help us find a different pathway to impact on rather than the one that's currently being treated.
So do we have enough information at this stage to figure out how many people might be genetically led to this?
So that's a tricky one. So we all carry all these genes that some will give us slightly bigger or lesser risk of the disease. And it's what's called a polygenic risk score. So you can add up all your pluses and minuses and you can work out what that risk is. But currently in AMD, we're pretty good at looking in and identifying that risk just by looking at the very beautiful imaging that you can get at the retina. There's a scan called an OCT scanner, and that image is really like a histological picture of the back of the eye. So if a retinal specialist has a look at that, they can pretty much predict what your chances are of losing vision in the near term. And so at the moment, adding the genetics hasn't been found to be particularly helpful in looking at your risk, but definitely they're the pathways that we're targeting with our treatments.
Yeah. Professor Robin Geimer has been doing this work for decades now. She's with you as part of CIRA, as she's described it, which is the Centre for Eye Research Australia, which is 30 years old. I have to ask you, Robin, while you're here, you were awarded the Elizabeth Blackburn Fellowship for the top ranked female research fellowship in clinical medicine. That was back in 2016. As I mentioned, you're a member of the Order of Australia as well. How much has life changed for female scientists and researchers in the 30 years? What would you say has been the biggest change for you?
I think the recognition, certainly with the granting bodies, that you need to take what's called relative opportunity into account when you're going for grants, because maybe your listeners don't realise that when we compete for grants, we're looked individually at our track record, and it has always been difficult for female researchers to compete just with the mere number of years that you're able to dedicate to the research. So now there's definitely inbuilt in granting schemes this ability to say that you've had time off to raise children, for example.
And it's not counting against you. Would you say it's fair yet or getting fairer?
Oh, definitely doesn't count against you, but I just don't think that you can really add the number of months that you were away on maternity leave as a representative of the number of hours that actually you may spend extra raising your family compared to male counterparts. But it definitely is a step in the right direction.
How much longer are you going to be doing this, Robin?
Oh, well, I was lucky enough to get another 5-year investigator grant from the NHMRC.
Excellent.
So I'll be around for 5 more years anyhow.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us today, and well done on all your research and good luck with all of those new things.
Thanks very much, Mary.
That's Robin Geimer, AM, and CIRA, Centre for Eye Research Australia, is celebrating its 30th year. It is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I do want to get to some of your calls about the things we've been talking about, aged care charges, Bazball, and, as I say, macular degeneration as well. But coming up next, a wonderful story, a Geelong-based theatre group. We know them, we love them, and now France knows them and has honoured them as well.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, you might have heard of Back to Back Theatre. It's based in Geelong and it has been getting attention for 30 years, as we were just talking about, the past three decades. Back to Back Theatre has been questioning what's possible in theatre, the assumptions we hold about ourselves as well. And we know that this year, 2026, it has been recognised in France, in the Festival d'Automne à Paris. It's one of the most important festivals in the world, and it is giving a tribute to Back to Back. Artistic director for the theatre is Bruce Gladwin, who can explain more how significant this is. Hello, Bruce. Thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
Can you explain about the Festival d'Automne à Paris, and I hope I haven't mangled that too much, how significant is it, this celebration, this tribute to you?
Well, you know, the festival itself is, as you said, is one of the largest festivals in Europe. It runs for the whole season of autumn. So it runs across the end of October, November and December. And it involves multiple venues all throughout Paris. So we have been invited, Back to Back has been invited to present what's called a portrait. And each year there's an artist in theatre or dance that is invited to come and present a portrait of their work. And it's presenting not just one work, but multiple works across multiple venues in Paris. So we will be resident there for a bit over 2 months and mm-hmm. presenting five separate works across a range of quite high profile venues. And so it's, you know, it's, it feels like for us, it's, well, for us, it's an opportunity to present like a retrospective of our work. So we're presenting works, some of which the oldest work would be Small Metal Objects, which we made for Flinders Street Station in 2005, through to the newest work that we're working on, which is not yet completed and will be showing audiences an open rehearsal of us in the process of making that work. So,
fantastic.
We're thrilled.
Yeah. So from Geelong to a residency in Paris for 8 weeks. Fantastic. Mm. That's in November and December. For people who aren't familiar with Back to Back Theatre, how would you describe it in your words?
Well, it's built around a core ensemble of six actors who are perceived to have either an intellectual disability or are neurodiverse. And the company started in Geelong in the mid-1980s after deinstitutionalisation. So those artists are the kind of writers and performers of the work. And I would describe the work as quite avant-garde, idiosyncratic, reflecting contemporary issues and really playful in theatrical form. So it's all original work co-written with the performers. And, you know, it's quite funny and dark and touching on, you know, that what sits between us and what sits within us. So it's kind of deep and psychological and, you know, magical at times. Mm.
1300 222 774. If you have seen Back to Back Theatre, let us know what you think. 1300 222 774. I'm speaking with Bruce Gladwin, who is the artistic director. So in that sense, Bruce, you have had to carry quite, a prestigious tradition there.
Yeah, well, I'm the fourth artistic director and I'm very, I guess, privileged in a way to kind of build on the repertoire and the creative capital that has been with the company, and also to have the opportunity to collaborate with the artists of the company. And the ensemble, as I said, are the real heart of the organisation. And we're very fortunate. We have two assets in the company. One is personnel, and the other is time. And very early in the company's creation, there was a strong commitment to the idea of going, let's build work and create and write work over a number of years and then try and tour that work. So very early on in the company's generation, or, you know, at the start of the company's formation, is this idea of investing in the making of the work and then keeping that work in repertoire and then touring that work to as many places as possible.
So how did the ensemble react when they knew they would have a two-month residency in Paris?
I think totally thrilled, of course. And I think everyone's, you know, we've been touring Europe probably for about 20 years as a company, and we've performed Paris many times before. And some of the works that we will be presenting in Paris, we have presented there before, but it's really this idea of a retrospective that is, I think, is going to be a bit of a marathon for us. And for some of the performers, they're performing across four works. Others are just coming for one or two works. And this idea of being able to kind of retain and hold these, you know, quite dense texts in their heads and be able to perform multiple works simultaneously is, I think, it's going to be a real physical and kind of mental challenge.
Absolutely. And some of those older works, obviously, some of the ensemble will not have perhaps performed before.
Yeah, and look, we've had some challenges, like we've had to recast some of the roles because the actors that created them have now left the company. And that's been really difficult because ultimately these works have been created by the performers that wrote them. And so, and those performers are quite idiosyncratic in their approach, and finding, in a way, we've had to rework some of the performances to accommodate the new performers. But again, it's like breathing life into these works, and you know, it's not like a museum piece. It's like we have to kind of engage with audiences in the real time in the contemporary world, and we're doing everything we can to, you know, breathe life into these works.
Well, Bruce, congratulations and good luck with all the preps. Make sure you pack those woolies for that time of year in Paris, but I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Bruce Gladwin is back-to-back artistic director. And I should have noticed as well, noted that this is the first ever portrait presentation by an Australian artist in that prestigious festival. So good on Back-to-Back Theatre. This as well from Marty on Back-to-Back Theatre. Since seeing Mr. September in the 90s, I've been a Back-to-Back Theatre groupie. They're an absolute treasure and such a brilliant asset to Geelong. They're heading off to Paris, as we heard later this year. Thank you for joining me on The Conversation Hour today. It's so wonderful to be with you again. I'll be back with you all this week. Write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au.